I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome, everyone, to Spark My Muse. Today's guest is Kevin Ferguson. He is a writer and a magician out of the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm so happy to have him. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
So I found you by way of Nautilus magazine and an article about science, the science of magic and psychology and perception, and it was a very intriguing article, at which we can go into more in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you a few questions about your own interests in magic and as a magician. What are the things that draw you most to this art form?
Well, I guess I should start by saying that I got into magic when I was a kid, and I think most people who find themselves performing professionally did get into magic when they were younger, when they were 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. And I think magic has this, it pulls people to it because of what it offers. It offers this kind of like, well, it offers this magic. You can do the impossible, right? And so as a kid, and I think as adults too, but especially as kids, we have this like dream of being larger than we really are. We want to be, be superheroes and mm-hmm. be able to fly and all this stuff. And so magic is definitely a great shortcut to be able to do those kinds of things.
Yeah, I can relate too. I saw one of the things you had linked on your YouTube channel was your talk at Google and talking mm-hmm. about wanting to be a Jedi and wanting to lift things.
Right.
And
right.
I remember definitely sensing those things in my own, creative imagination as a kid. What if I could fly? What if I could figure out a way to move stuff with my mind? And
right. And
that sense of wonder that, those things, of course, later you find out that magicians are actually just tricking you. But the part of the magic too is that once you know they are tricking you and you just don't know how they are, that's actually still fun too.
It can be.
Obviously in a different way.
It frustrates some people.
Yeah.
Some people are just like, I guess it depends on how the trick is presented and how who the performer is, if you like the person or don't like the person. Mm-hmm. I think often magic tricks can be presented as puzzles, mm-hmm. which sometimes kind of pit the audience against the magician. And trying to figure it out. And it's kind of a lose-lose situation where if you don't figure it out as an audience member, mm-hmm. then you lose. If you do figure it out, then the magic trick's ruined and you also lose. And the magician goes home and cries himself to sleep. So it can be a delicate balance with magic, but yeah.
Yeah, and maybe you've had a wet pillow before a night's sleep, but I know with like Penn and Teller, they add all kinds of like macabre and crazy humor, and you feel like you're in it with them, and or the joke's not necessarily on you, right. or it's kind of you're in it together, and it kind of can pull you in together, but the cleverness and knowing that your brain isn't quite keeping up with what's happening. That it's kind of bending reality and you're wondering what's real and what isn't. That brings up, at least for me, all of this, the idea of what we perceive and what's real and how our mm-hmm. mind can fool us. And that science-y side, the nerd in me, is really drawn to that and how easily we can be fooled by other people.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. When you start to go down the rabbit hole of magic in terms of like learning the art, you start to develop a keen sense of what is and isn't possible mm. in terms of what you see, because your training is essentially watching magic tricks and trying to figure them out.
Mm.
And so, it's funny. People always will send me YouTube videos or kind of tell me about magic tricks that they've seen and mm. ask me, how did he do it? It's impossible, right? And it's funny because if you ask any magician how another magic trick is done, mm-hmm. 99% of the time he'll know exactly how it was done or could figure out a way to do it, like could come up with a different method to accomplish the same thing.
Mm.
And it's because there's only a limited amount of things you can do, and when you train to figure out how to deceive people in this kind of like narrow magical field,
mm-hmm.
It turns out there's not much behind it. I mean, maybe that's peeking behind the curtain a little bit too much, but
next thing you'll say Santa isn't real, and then right. there's going to be tears. So
right, I won't say that.
Well, it makes me wonder from your perspective as an actual performing magician, was there ever a trick where, I mean, you're saying that since you know the back end of it and you know how things right. are basically done, was there ever a trick where you're like, I don't know what happened, but I have to find out how to do that trick?
Absolutely. There's a few tricks that still stump me, and they were all done by this magician in the UK who I was lucky enough to meet a few years ago, a guy named Darren Brown. Mm. And he does a touring stage production. He's also been on TV for the past 15 years or so. People in the United States don't really know who he is as much, but he's very, very popular in the United Kingdom. Mm. And in any case, he does kind of like this, a similar style of magic as I do, like faking reading minds and predicting the future. I have to say faking because what we do is not real. But he's done a few tricks that just, I don't understand how they would be possible in believing, if I were to believe certain things about him, like he doesn't use stooges and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you think he doesn't use stooges?
No, he's claimed that he doesn't use stooges for pretty much his whole career. Mm. And once you start using audience members as props in the sense of like telling them what to do, before the show or that kind of thing, it kind of ruins the magic. So mm-hmm. I'd like to believe he doesn't do that, but mm-hmm. who knows?
Yeah, I saw some of his YouTube videos, and I was terribly impressed. I couldn't
figure
it out.
You just can't wrap your head around it.
Oh,
yeah.
I know. When he's calling people and he's telling them things that they're interested in, these it seems mm-hmm. so random, and you really can't. You cannot tell what's happening unless they've done a lot of research behind the scenes on the guests or something.
He's famous for presenting magic as like kind of psychology in the sense of like, or at least kind of faking or suggesting that the methods that he uses are not magical. And in fact, they're psychological. Mm. And especially earlier on in his career, he would kind of suggest overtly, seemingly innocently that he was using kind of cold reading or other, you know, body language reading or this kind of thing to achieve his means, when in fact he was using regular magic tricks. So he's misdirecting the method from what the actual method is.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. One of the things, too, that I kind of appreciated about the things he's done, he hasn't been, and at the same time, he hasn't been like nasty, condescending toward people of faith, which I appreciate that. But he has done some things where he will debunk things like psychics and faith healers without, at the same time, sort of slapping people around who actually have found comfort in those things.
Sure, sure.
Sure. So that's a fine line to walk. So I appreciate that he's gentle with that.
But it's funny because like most of the people I talk about him or I talk with him about are other magicians, and magicians tend to be like Darren Brown, not people of faith.
And right.
It's great to hear that, you know, someone who, you know, that other people feel the same way that he is treating people respectfully, because I have the perspective of, you know, kind of being on his side before seeing. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, you can do what you can do what he's doing and say, this is a whole lot of baloney and here's why. And let me show you how to do the same things without mm-hmm. saying, if you happen to believe you're a moron, but at the same time, you should still challenge whatever it is you happen to believe. You should still challenge it and see if you're being fooled. Like,
yeah.
And I appreciate that. And I loved how he would show how cold readings work, and he would show how faith healers are using hypnotist techniques, which I think is really, really important to show people how they can be deceived, and mm-hmm. how, the same hypnotist tricks of working people up into an adrenaline and a lather kind of, and then telling them things that they'll believe or they won't feel pain anymore or something is a clever hypnotic trick. And that bridges over somehow in ways people have never even thought of before.
Yeah. And it comes back to like two things, the whole kind of like psychology behind how people, you know, think, are deceived or influenced, and also the skeptical mindset that, being a magician kind of inculcates in you know, in how you look at things. You know, he will watch a faith healing session trying to look for an alternate explanation Like, that's kind of like the skeptical mindset of the magician is, okay, I know, or given that this is not possible, how could it be done?
Right. And
so maybe it's a weird place to go from, but that's kind of like how the magicians think.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of works as a good segue into your article talking about the study of magic as a science and what your article is about. And maybe for people who, hopefully they'll read it from a link in my show notes or just go straight to Nautilus Magazine, but you can maybe talk about what interested you in writing it in the first place and then what some of the main points are in what you write.
Right. So the article is on Nautilus Magazine. It's a very cool magazine. It's like a science and culture publication based in New York, print and online. And basically, I wrote this piece kind of profiling a guy named Gustav Kuhn. And Gustav Kuhn is a magician, but he's also a scientist. And what he decided to do was to use psychology and magic and put them together and try and figure out, or at least kind of further this field that had already been, there'd been a few studies like using magic to try and figure out things about the brain. But he wanted to kind of collect all of these studies together and try and push and make and suggest that perhaps there should be an actual field, the study of kind of like the psychology of magic. And he's got some very good reasons for thinking that that's a, that'd be a good idea. Because as I say in the article, there are interesting things about magic that you can't find elsewhere. Magicians train to deceive. So if you want to study how people's beliefs are formed, manipulated, or you know, changed in some small way, it wouldn't be a bad idea to use the magician's tool set, you know. So he's done studies where he does, he uses eye tracking to follow kind of like a sleight of hand piece of magic where you see, okay, if the magician pretends to put the you know, coin in his right hand, or if you see him place, if you see, quote unquote, see him put the coin in his right hand, but it's really in his left, where do the eyes go the whole time? So they can watch how people watch magic, which will, which gives you kind of a unique perspective on how people, what people attend to when they're watching things, the limits of attention. So those are a few different things, like the limits of attention, how beliefs are formed, agency. It's very interesting how, in terms of belief formation, how people feel that they're the agents of their own kind of like actions. And yet some magic tricks use that against you in terms of like, you know, maybe a magic trick that has to do with like mind reading or predicting the future can make you maybe question if you actually do have that agency that you thought you did.
And also the events that violate causality. I thought that was really fascinating. Maybe you could unpack that. Magical thinking. So
This idea of magical thinking is that is basically any attribution of causal kind of like causal an attribution of cause to something that does not have, that is not exactly linked. So a good example of that would be, you know, maybe you have a lucky sock and you think that when you wear the lucky sock that you'll hit a home run, right? Classic. And so you, maybe you wore the lucky sock once, or you think it's more likely going to make you hit a home run. So you always wear it. So you're attributing cause in a magical way to wearing the sock, to an action that cannot possibly be linked to it in terms of actual, like, you know, apart from maybe, you know, making you more confident in this kind of thing, it doesn't actually change how kind of like the world works. In the sciences, they also talk about prayer. If you pray that you're going to get, that you're going to get a promotion and then you get a promotion, that prayer, there's no real reason, there's no scientific logical reason to think that those two things would be connected. And, but this is everywhere. This is in a magic trick, but this is also in just like, you know, in sports, in work,
And people look for the patterns. And so sometimes they're, if they, for instance, if they have a lucky, like you're saying, a lucky sock, and they they do well, maybe they're not looking at all the times they did poorly and they're just looking for the good things. Or if it's in the case of a placebo effect or something, they might not be realizing that they were, for instance, if they, you know, took a sugar pill, they're not going to realize that they were going to get better anyway after 10 to 14 days from a virus or something.
Right.
And so some of those things are just misattributed. But what's fascinating to me is when placebo actually changes what the brain is actually doing. And that's kind of the more strange thing, so that the brain chemistry is actually changing to cure disease. And so,
yeah.
And that's really wild. Strange too, because there's actually something going on where the immune system will bump up for no reason, except for that the mind has decided to sort of change and the brain chemistry has decided to sort of change based on the suggestion, which is kind of in the hypnosis area, right, as well.
Yeah.
And the Darren Brown things that I was watching, I don't know if you've seen this one, probably you've seen everything that he's done, right, but he does the assassin. There's the assassin show, mm-hmm. Where he hypnotizes someone to kill somebody. I mean, obviously that he doesn't,
right,
the person
right.
doesn't really kill them, but he has an amnesia hypnosis too, so they don't even remember doing it. And I'll put a link in the show notes. This is absolutely a mind-boggling. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't even believe that.
He hypnotizes a guy to think, to basically be triggered to assassinate someone with a gun in a theater, right? And so it's all fake, and the gun is fake, and everything's fake. And I think it's just like a squirt gun or something, but I can't remember. It's been years since I've watched it. But the thing is, you take that on the first watch and you're like, wow, this is crazy. How could this be? And this seems so dangerous. But at the same time, you only have one test case of that situation. Mm-hmm. There's so much behind it. And so few people are... It's possible to do that with, or the kind of people who are susceptible have that talent of being hypnotized.
Right.
But at the same time, it's impossible to know what those person's experience is.
Yeah.
So like for this person who, you know, quote unquote, was going to assassinate someone because of hypnosis or because they were triggered by this hypnotic setup, that for everyone listening took, you know, weeks and weeks to set up.
Yeah.
If not months, we don't know if they at any point actually thought that they were going to kill someone, even with that trigger. Like it's possible that their experience of it was, oh, I know this is fake and I know I'm not actually going to kill someone.
Right.
And even if we were to ask that person, they may also misremember the situation as it was at the time. So all these things, there's these other possibilities of what those, you know, what could actually be taken away from those kind of what on first look seem impossible and also scary.
Right.
Don't know what actually went down.
Yeah, it's still a TV show for ratings and everything like that. So, yeah, and it was based on what was at least impressive for ratings anyway, was that they were basing that off of the Robert Kennedy assassination, where Sirhan says that he was brainwashed by the CIA, and he still claims that after all these many years, and they tried to replicate some of those, some of his remembrances about a trigger of a woman in a polka dot dress and all this stuff. Right. And they tried to keep it as much as they could to that case. But it's true that the people who are suggestible and most compliant will be the people who would respond. It's not like you can just pick anyone just randomly, and then, you know, in a few minutes they get them to assassinate somebody. But it was compelling television anyway.
Definitely compelling television, that is for sure.
Oh my goodness. And so that's really when we're talking about in terms of I had always thought that hypnosis, and maybe you can give me your take on this, that hypnosis was something that, well, I should back up. So I came from a really fundamentalist Christian background where there was a fire and brimstone, like, you know, trying to get people to convert under fire and brimstone threats, right? And so That is a part of my past. And so it was definitely hypnosis was in the satanic,
right.
You know, devil worship. You know, you definitely don't want to be hypnotized because Satan's going to come into your head.
Right.
Okay, so fast forward.
Yep.
So fast forward to hypnosis being an altered state and thinking about who's susceptible and who isn't. I still was under the impression that hypnosis was something that you could encounter but not do anything against your will or you're kind of consenting to whatever it is. And so I'm wondering, what's your opinion, Kevin, on hypnotic states? Because I know that hypnosis is part of your performing. And so do you think that people can do things that they would not want to do? Do you think that you could get someone to do something that they would not ethically want to do? And do you think that crosses the line with ethics?
Yeah, so I don't have... my experience in hypnosis is limited compared to those people who do it professionally, especially people like Darren Brown. Mm-hmm. I use it limitedly in my performance, and I have done hypnosis on friends and acquaintances and you know, kind of just experimented with it in the past, but I'm by no means like a performing expert right on this topic, but I have read extensively about it, and I think that you'll find my opinion valuable because basically I'll be channeling those opinions of those people who are more experienced. But I think the main consensus, at least in terms of the people that I have spoken to about it and read up on it, people like Darren Brown, is that in terms of agency, it's hard to suggest or it's hard to know for sure, like I was saying earlier, but I think the main consensus is that you cannot get someone to do something really that they wouldn't want to do otherwise, especially in like a short-term hypnosis experience where the classic hypnotist pulls you up on stage during a hypnotist show and you do wacky things. Maybe you wouldn't normally do those things if you hadn't been hypnotized, but it's not like you're going to go, you know, on a murderous rampage or, you know, tear all of your clothes off and scream at the top of your lungs, or you know, you may act like a chicken or whatever, but you won't necessarily do anything that you would have thought is immoral.
Oh,
but
okay.
That's not to say that you wouldn't do, because and it's because, especially in these kind of like short-term hypnosis experiences where you're hypnotized quickly or over like 15 minutes or whatever, it's hard even to say if these people are actually hypnotized. Like the idea, the question of what the hypnosis state is. If there's the question of, is there even a hypnotic state that someone enters in? Like, is there a different brain state that you go into? Does your brain change in a certain way that we can measure scientifically? What is that state? How do people respond to it? And how do people act in it? Are all questions. There's been studies that use hypnosis to... as like an analgesis, like to pain reduction for cancer patients and this kind of thing. And there's studies that suggest that you can be hypnotized and it's effective on helping you manage your pain. But, you know, all you're doing basically is focusing your mind. Like you're training your brain on your own. You're not being really hypnotized in the sense of like, and sleep, right?
Right. Yeah. And that really is interesting. And now, are you aware that there are any like fMRIs that record what's happening in the brain in the altered state of hypnosis?
Yeah, I'm sure there are. I was researching. I did some research and wrote a paper on this a few years ago. Must have been like 4 or 5 years ago now. So I'm not exactly up to date on my knowledge of the science, the updated science of hypnosis. But I'm sure it's out there.
Yeah, I would imagine there's been a lot of progress in 3D image scanning too. So it would be really interesting to see what things are lighting up where, in terms of like an altered brain state. Because I would imagine it would be similar to like a meditative state.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that can be achieved in so many different ways. Whether it's like a prayer state or just deep relaxation or yoga.
The difference is the agency. Okay. In the hypnotic state, at least unless you're hypnotizing yourself, which certainly you can do and people do, which is way more like meditation than anything. Okay. I think you probably should be called meditation, but because in my opinion it is pretty much identical. But if you're being hypnotized, the difference is agency. You are being controlled and directed and guided by someone. Where, and you can think, okay, guided meditation, you're guided by someone else to go in a certain way. But in hypnosis, at least, especially in stage hypnosis, or even in hypnosis in general, where it's like therapy, therapeutic hypnosis, you are being guided along your journey by someone else. And you are attributing the cause of the state to this person and not you, which is which is different.
Yeah.
I think one of the main, like, interesting, I mean, the main questions I get about hypnosis is like, you know, first, is it possible? And also, how does it work? And really, the only reason it works is that you believe, you as the person being hypnotized, believe that you will be hypnotized by this person. If you get told that there's a master hypnotist, that I'm a master hypnotist, and then you, if you see me hypnotize like four people in a row, even if they're all actors, then I go up to you and I grab your arm and I snap right above your head and I kind of yank you a little bit and do this classic like instant induction technique, it's very likely that you will fall into this hypnosis state. Maybe you won't go super, super deep into it, but you'll push over the edge and you'll think, wow, am I hypnotized? And then maybe I could lead you further and further.
It's sort of cooperative then. I mean,
it's absolutely cooperative. Yeah. You cannot be hypnotized unless you want to, pretty much.
Yeah. And it's, there's a lot of social cues and social pressure. It really is fascinating.
For sure. Especially on stage.
Right. That is really interesting. I was just listening to a podcast called Fable Podcast, and the guy was talking about his thing with Benny Hinn. He got dragged up on stage by someone who wanted him to be healed, and he faked fell when Benny Hinn touched his head.
Just
faked fell. He was like, well, I didn't want him to be embarrassed that I didn't fall. So it's like, it's almost like, you know, you're going along with it, but.
And that's very likely to be the case for a lot of stage hypnosis and hypnotists. You can't know after. It's same thing for a magician. If I do a magic trick, I don't get the opportunity to ask everyone after the show, hey, were you fooled by that? How did you think it was done, right? Did you figure it out? Yeah. All I hear is like the people who come up afterwards and say, wow, that was amazing. You know, everyone else just leaves, right? So you have this extremely biased audience representation of what your actual act is. And that goes for any performer for sure, which is why performers out there, it's very important to get critical feedback.
be open.
Do not trust your audience.
And in terms of the science of magic and things like disorders, mental disorders like schizophrenia, it also brings up the possibility of understanding pathological states in the brain or states of like childhood wonder before you're skeptical of the world and everything's possible, as your article says, in a childlike mind. And so I guess there is something to be gained by thinking of magic as, or the study of magic, so-called, as an avenue to gain some insights into those aspects too.
Yeah, that you bring up one of the most interesting kind of components and one of the unique components of magic as an art form. Kind of like doing, you know, using the kid kind of analogy. As kids, everything is magic, right? Everything is magic. You just walk around and you haven't seen. There's so much you haven't seen before that you're constantly in awe of like anything, and that's why you can go like play for hours in the backyard or in the woods by yourself and just discover constantly. Whereas adults, we live way more monotonous lives where it's kind of like the same thing every day, and there's way less discovery and kind of way more just, yeah, it's kind of depressing. But but you know, especially when it seems like a lot of our lives are designed to kind of consume and consume and consume, and just kind of like be kind of like a vegetable on our iPhones and on our computers all the time, and then we go to work and we do our work. Whereas, you know, people ask me why I don't do kid shows, or they often ask me, hey, do you do kid shows? Like, you're a magician. I want you to do a kid show for my kid. And I'm like, no, I don't do kid shows. And here's why. Kids have way too much magic. Okay, they have too much magic. Adults have almost none all the time. And And magic is one of the only areas in which you can show an adult something impossible that they haven't seen before and that they do not understand, which is what the experience of wonder is, I think. Mm-hmm. Like this childlike kind of like emotion, or we associate it with children because children are constantly like wide-eyed, kind of mm-hmm. like looking around like, whoa, right? Mm-hmm. And you can only really get that in the pursuit of discovery, adventure, novelty mm-hmm. that comes from, you know, maybe like watching Cosmos, you know, on TV with Neil Tyson, or or you know, going on a trip to a faraway land that you've never been to, or watching some crazy documentary that tells you something very interesting. And we all mm-hmm. like these experiences, but magic, especially in person, you get it right in front of your very eyes. And it's also suggesting that there is no answer. Mm. Whereas like or often it says there's no answer. We present you an unsolvable puzzle. Mm. And then we just right in front of your eyes, just take it apart. We say, look. And so you say, what in the world? How is that possible? And it right. brings you to this sense of, I think, kind of like wonder in that one moment where you are kind of frozen, at least you're stuck in the present. Which is, I think, what we were talking about with the science of wonder. Like, what is the experience in terms of like what Kuhn is researching and what the possible research is in the future? What is that brain state of being in awe and in wonder, feeling wonder at something that you can't explain? And does that feeling have therapeutic effects? There's been a little research on it, but not a lot. And that's what Gustav Kuhn and his fellow researchers are looking into.
Yeah, I think, and it's a peaceful place to be in a state of wonder. And it strikes me that here you are a magician, but you're living in the San Francisco area, which is like mm-hmm. full of engineers and people who like are very, you know, predictable and tech industry. And they're like, wonder maybe the furthest thing, potentially the furthest thing from their lives, because they're going to be like, no, I'm living in the real.
I perform for a lot of software engineers and technology people. And they're a great audience. They're a great audience, but they're very often it's like it's hard to get them to, especially one-on-one, when you put them in theater, dim the lights, you put the music on during the stage shows, and you can get people to kind of like suspend their disbelief and go along for the ride. But one-on-one in person, they're way more likely to be like, okay, how was that done?
Right, just let me give me the goods.
Wait, show me again. Show me again. Let me
Yeah, they want to peek behind the curtain at every turn, probably.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah, not going to be like,
that's the kind of like thing that comes from being mm-hmm. you know, working in a field where you're constantly creating new things and looking for answers and spending a lot of time trying to, especially like the engineer mindset, I think is way more aimed toward kind of like figuring things out and solving puzzles and that kind of thing. So
yeah, it would be now have you performed magic in different parts of the world?
I have. The last thing I was part of was a thing called Band of Magicians, which was touring in New Zealand, and I was there last year working as a backstage magician and kind of like on the film crew. It was in these huge like kind of 1,000-person theaters where we had a big screen that came down so that people could see the close-up tricks that were done on the screen. So I was working the camera, and at a certain point, the cameramen were a part of one illusion where they switched with the magicians. Like all of a sudden, the cameramen were the magicians, and so that was pretty fun. I wasn't one of the actual magicians on stage doing the show, mm-hmm. But a friend of mine produced the show and asked me to join him and his other friends on the adventure. And I thought it'd be awesome. So that was
great.
The last thing I did outside of the States.
Yeah, that sounds really fun. What a great opportunity. Really. Yeah, and I was just thinking that culturally, you're going to get such a wide range. I remember hearing David Blaine talking about going to, I'm not sure if it was Trinidad, one of the islands down in the Caribbean. When mm-hmm. he would do a magic trick, they were totally ready to like light him on fire. You know,
right.
They were like, oh no, that's voodoo. You are out of here. You know, it depends on where your audience is, how excited or, you know, in wonder or basically ready to burn you as a witch or, you know, wanting to know what you're exactly doing, like the mechanics of it.
Yeah, I've performed magic kind of like all over the place. I've performed it all across Europe and mm-hmm. in New Zealand and And in San Francisco is such a multicultural city that you get tourists all the time coming from all over the world that, you know, I will perform for. Mm-hmm. And so while I haven't done official like stage productions around the world, I have definitely had the experience of performing for different people who come from different backgrounds. And there is this very varied kind of like experience of what magic is. It's funny. It's, you know, you don't want to stereotype people, but the, you know, especially tourists who come from Japan tend to have like this wild experience of like card tricks, which is just so fun to perform magic tricks for them. And then, but you're right. It's like how, you know, one of the funny things is, you know, who, what are people willing to believe and what are people ready to believe? You know, some people will watch, but it's like, you know, you get an engineer to watch a magic trick and they're like, no, or I don't want to, you know, I'm not trying to blanket everyone, but like kind of like many engineers that I've performed for will be like, okay, I know that was a trick. Okay. Tell me how it was done.
Yeah.
And, but you'll get some people who watch a magic trick who perhaps are more open to it than who then believe actually that I can do something that I cannot do at all. You know,
yeah.
A lot of my tricks have to do with mind reading. And so, or predicting the future or predicting kind of choices that you'll make. And after, you know, for example, if you were to, if I had you write a poem right now, like a haiku, right, across Skype, across, you know, I can't, obviously I cannot know what poem you're going to write. But then if you wrote it down and showed it up to the camera, and then I had a piece of paper right here, and then I showed that it was the exact same, right? You would think there, I mean, you would perhaps, because I've told you that I can't do these things, you'd look for alternate explanations. But many people would think you can read my mind or see into the future or how the hell it was done. You know, there's like, there's the, no, I know it wasn't possible. There's the, okay, maybe it was possible, or let me look for how, you know, how it was done. I don't know. And then there's like, I believe you. And some people just believe that you can do magic after you demonstrate them one thing, which brings this kind of like moral obligation or like ethical question of like, what do I tell people during the show and after the show to maintain the illusion, but also not leave, get at, you know, have people leave the audience or leave the show thinking that things that are possible that aren't possible in the world.
Well, it's an interesting conundrum of the Western secular mind, because in other contexts, you know, there's shaman and they're like, yeah, so what? It's possible. You know, I've wondered, whatever. But if you're Western, American, secular, then you're like, oh crap, I can't let them think I'm magical. You know? So, it's a conundrum, because you don't want to act like you're someone you're not when it's a trick, you know? But at the same time, like how I experience magic is I'll go, what?
Right.
Oh, how did that happen? And then sometimes like, yeah, I don't know, but that was really cool.
Yeah.
And I stay in the wonder and I enjoy it and I don't have to know, but of course I know it's a trick, but I don't think, you know, this super, you know, there's something supernatural going on, but at the same time, I love wonder and I love being curious. And if I could find out, I probably would. But at the same time, I also like not knowing, because I actually like that feeling.
Because there's so few things that you don't know anymore that are not Googleable, that you can't just find out, you know, in like 10 seconds. Every question that popped into our heads these days, we're just like, oh, who is that actor that was in that movie? Oh, this person. And they're also in all these movies. And, you know, we have like the Library Britannica in our pockets.
Right. Siri, how does this trick work, Siri?
Yeah.
You know,
once that happens, well, I'm going to be totally screwed. But that's going to be.
Your gig is up, dude. Yeah. Well, it's true. And so there's some like demystifying every last freaking thing, because everything can be known, kind of sucks. And so you don't want to be like an ignorant moron that thinks everything is spooky and everything is, you know, the gods must be angry or whatever. Right. But at the same time, there's something to be said that that knowledge will kind of make, you know, enough knowledge will make everything bland. And
well, I think the problem is shallow knowledge and kind of like throwaway knowledge that's kind of filling our lives. So we have, you know, we have this kind of addiction to the answer, even if we don't care at all what the answer is, like, and that we'll forget it 10 seconds later, right? Yeah. Unless you're, do you actually need to know what the, who the celebrity's husband's name is? Like, it doesn't, you're going to forget later, or it doesn't matter. And so we have this kind of like, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but we have the byproduct of kind of like the cell phones and the internet being always with us is that we are used to, and it almost addicted to, or at least like it's become a habit to just have the answer to everything. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things to do is to just not have your phone and just be curious about something, mm-hmm. not know, and then just move on with your life.
Oh, see, you're young enough that that's novel to you. That to me, that's right. Just the good old days.
I know.
You're like, oh, what must that be like? I'm like, that was like, for me, that was like when I was your age.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, there's a weird slavery to having knowledge constantly and having it connected to you, because there is sort of a weird. There is a weird bondage to it. It's really strange to say it like that, I suppose. But mm-hmm. I will purposefully leave my I'll purposefully leave my phone in my car when I'm going to restaurants, because sometimes I don't want to answer those questions and be interrupted by the stupidity of those types of things. Like, hey, yeah. I wonder what, and I'll be like, oh, I left my phone in my car. Oh well, I guess I'll never know, because it's those types of interruptions that I think can take away from the deepness and the quality of conversations that we have with people sometimes, that cheapen the interaction in, to go to a deeper level, then you get distracted by these weird rabbit trails.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a, I end up talking about phones and culture, but it's
not magical.
It's a, I mean, it's mm-hmm. a, yeah, it's like, I think it's right in that like the shallow knowledge is a problem, but like, I think, and phones can be used in a great way. Like seeing a group of people surrounded around a phone, sharing an experience together, like that's valuable. Fine. Yeah. But, where phones are used to escape your first person kind of like experience of the world, mm-hmm. That's where I think it's a problem.
Yeah. So see, if you did a magic trick where someone's iPhone disappeared, at that point, you know that you would not make it alive out of whatever show you were performing.
Oh, absolutely. There's actually a great like Russian roulette trick where you get a bunch of, where you have like a couple fake phones, and then you get a phone from someone, and then you put them all in paper bags and mix them up and have the person smash, smash like four of, out of the five of them, and you hope that the last one is his. I won't ruin the ending, but...
Oh my gosh, that's so that's like a terrorist act right there. You could probably like kill someone's grandmother on stage, or and they would pick that over getting their phone smashed. But it's crazy. But this is great. I've had a lot of fun with you, Kevin, and I'm sure that people would enjoy seeing more of your writing and some of your work. And maybe you could let people know where they can best find you.
Sure. You can find all of my various links and everywhere that I exist in the digital world at kferg.me. That's kferg.me. That has all my social links and my other websites, my writing and my magic. So check it out.
Thank you. There'll be some show notes with all those links and all the related articles that I can find that you've done. And you do pretty much, do you do a lot of writing right now, or are you just getting
into
that?
I do about one article for this Nautilus magazine a month.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, I've really gotten into Nautilus, and I keep finding things and then trying to hunt down the authors and be like, would you talk to me? So
<Yeah.
laughs> it's a great magazine. And yeah, I'm really happy that we could spend some time together today.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much for having me.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.